Today on the UW Medicine Pulse Podcast, the human brain.
I think it's easily the most remarkable thing in the universe. It has a complexity that's unrivaled in anything else that we encounter. Yet we can take it for granted. We can look at a sunset, we can smell something, have a memory, and these things flow seamlessly.
It's biology's greatest mystery, how the brain works. But thanks to amazing new technologies, researchers at UW Medicine and elsewhere are beginning to unravel some of the brain's mysteries, opening the way for advances in the treatment of neurological disorders like Alzheimer's, epilepsy, and stroke. Today, we'll share some of their discoveries with you.
This is the UW Medicine Pulse with Marty Reamer. Real-world stories of the discoveries being made at UW Medicine and the impact they're having on people here in the Pacific Northwest and around the world.
The human brain is incredibly complex and remarkably efficient. Consider this. The adult human brain weighs about 3 pounds. That's about half the weight of the average laptop computer. It's made up of between 80 and 100 billion nerve cells, as many nerve cells as there are stars in the Milky Way. The brain stores the equivalent of 3.5 quadrillion bytes of data. That's 3.5 million billions. And it does this while burning less than 25 watts of energy, about the same as a small light bulb. Incredibly complex, remarkably efficient. It should not be surprising, then, that with that level of complexity, things can go wrong, like the inability to effectively access some of those 3.5 quadrillion bytes of data that are stored in your head.
If you look at the brains of people who are 80 or 85, many of them, probably most of them, will have some changes, some degenerative changes, not all, but the great majority. I think the lesson is that all of us, many or most of us, are going to be living with some degree of neurodegenerative change brain-wise. Our goal is to minimize how much that impacts daily functioning.
Dr. Thomas Grabowski holds many titles. He's a professor of neurology and radiology. He's the director of the Integrated Brain Imaging Center. And he's director of the Memory and Brain Wellness Center at UW Medicine.
This is UW Medicine's initiative to bring together clinical and research around degenerative disorders that lead to memory and other cognitive impairments. And that includes, you know, Alzheimer's disease prominently, but there are a number of other diseases which do that. There can be vascular injury to the brain, there can be Parkinson's disease and related disorders.
Most people can, within a fraction of a second, recall the name of their first grade teacher. In my case, Mrs. Lewis. Or the names of the characters on a TV show from their childhood that they haven't watched in 20, 30, or 40 years.
What was the name of your first grade teacher?
Mrs. Wetherill.
Do you remember any of the names of the characters on the Brady Bunch?
Cindy and Greg. Marcia and Marcia.
Do you remember your first grade teacher?
Yes.
What's her name?
Mrs. Richards.
The fact that your brain can store and recall such trivial information, on top of how to drive and what you had for breakfast and the shape of a maple leaf and on and on and on, is nothing short of remarkable. And it's this capability that begins to degrade with age.
Many of us have what we call senior moments. Retrieving people's names is something that seems to become problematic maybe really early on. We may misplace things, but these never conspire to really prevent us from doing what we want to do in our daily life. And that's really the test. You know, is there any impairment? And most of the time in this kind of situation, the answer is no. In fact, we're more worried about the people who aren't worried about the problem than we are about the people who are worried about it. And it is actually a major focus diagnostically for us. Many people have complaints of memory trouble, and we need to sort them out into the people who are mild cognitive impairment, maybe dementia, maybe something else going on.
Alzheimer's is a progressive form of dementia, and these senior moments aside, is strongly correlated with aging.
Alzheimer's disease will double in prevalence every 5 years. Epic, you go on beyond age 65. So it ramps up in people who are older. So by the time you hit age 80, 85, you know, there's probably 25-30% of people will have dementia.
One of the aspects of Alzheimer's that's especially perplexing is how differently it impacts different types of memories. Some say it's long-term memory versus short-term. But according to Dr. Grabowski, it's probably more complicated than that.
There's more than one sort of memory system in the brain. There's a system in which we remember new facts, new episodes, and there's a system in which we learn new procedures, new activities. The first one is something you do quickly. You can probably learn somebody's name in one try, for example. But you can't learn to ride a bike quickly. You use a different system, a so-called procedural learning system, or a habit learning system. And it turns out that habit learning system is relatively well off in Alzheimer's disease, at least in the beginning stages. People can still learn new habits, and we take advantage of that clinically in trying to help people cope with their disease.
So even though Alzheimer's is thought of as an old person's disease, research is showing that it gets a foothold years, even decades, before the symptoms of forgetfulness appear.
We now know that when people come in the door with dementia due to Alzheimer's disease, they already have fairly advanced disease as far as the brain goes. We increasingly have recognized an earlier stage of impairment, which has the sort of deceptively generic name of mild cognitive impairment. This is a syndrome of a relatively pure memory disorder that doesn't affect daily functioning, but is measurable and turns out to be the way that most people transition from a state of normal cognitive aging to Alzheimer's dementia. And the MCI stage is really an opportunity to intervene because people may not progress from MCI to dementia for a few years. We also now know that MCI itself is a relatively late phenomenon. There is a preclinical phase of Alzheimer's disease, and we don't know how long it lasts, but possibly decades. We're more and more focused on these early stages because this is the chance for prevention as treatments are developed for Alzheimer's disease. And this is the stage in which people are physically able to participate and make a difference in their health strategies.
So locking down a diagnosis as early as possible is part of where Grabowski and his team at the UW Medicine Memory and Brain Wellness Center are focusing their research. Genetic testing is one technique, since Alzheimer's appears to have a genetic component.
There's at least three genes to determine you will get it in an obligatory fashion. There's probably another 20 genes that influence your risk for this, some of them more than others, and there are more genes, I think, to be discovered. One of the things that we're doing, which is also state-of-the-art, is we do have genetic testing available, and we'll have even more sophisticated genetic testing available this year. That will let us evaluate much of this.
Just as important as genetics, or maybe even more important, is lifestyle. And again, we're talking lifestyle choices that are made well before the symptoms of Alzheimer's appear.
What you do in midlife has a big bearing on whether you develop dementia later. So things like healthy lifestyle reflected in regular aerobic exercise, in social engagement, in intellectually challenging pursuits, in simply in having a full education. All of these stave off your risk for Alzheimer's disease. They don't prevent it, but they make it appear later than it would otherwise do.
Szia, Laci.
Szia, Mari.
Köszönöm. Nagyon jól.
So the popular belief that solving a Sudoku or a crossword puzzle a day or challenging yourself mentally to, say, learn a new language...
Én sajnos rosszul.
Truly does have an impact.
But even in older age, the brain remains plastic. People learn things. That's all plasticity. And part of our scientific agenda is to try to understand that and how we can take advantage of that.
The human brain, 80 to 100 million cells, communicating with each other like a well-conducted orchestra. Except... in the case of a seizure.
Every time you use your brain, or even when you're just resting there, there are discharges or nerve cells that are having an electrical discharge.
Dr. Jeff Ogeman is a neurological surgeon, a brain surgeon at UW Medicine, who specializes in treating epilepsy.
Every time a nerve cell discharges, that can stimulate or activate other nerve cells. And so you have in your brain an extremely complicated network that we're only just barely beginning to understand. And somehow those discharges propagate, and you get what we might call a feed-forward problem, where each discharge creates more discharges and creates more until you have a seizure.
What exactly is causing the seizure isn't altogether clear.
Sometimes it's because we don't have enough of the type of chemicals that give the feedback that dampen a seizure. Sometimes it's a genetic problem where all the cells are too irritable. Sometimes it's a structural event like a stroke or a tumor that might be irritating the brain. But again, the exact mechanisms aren't understood.
Many people with epilepsy live independent, productive lives. They can manage their seizures quite effectively with medications.
So our Department of Neurology has a large number of neurologists, of clinicians that treat and evaluate people with epilepsy. First is making sure that they have seizures and not some other reason for the problems that they're having or the events that they're having. And then in those that are treated, picking the right medicine, the one with the least side effects, and the one that works the best. But that still leaves about a third of the people with epilepsy who don't have an effective medical treatment. And so what we've done here, and we're one of the first places in the country to use surgery routinely to try and treat epilepsy. And so our department has been leading in that since even the 1940s. And if you can define a piece of the brain where seizures are coming from, and if you can establish that it's at least relatively safe to take it out, then surgery can be one of the most effective treatments for ongoing epilepsy.
The surgical approach that's been used for decades to treat epilepsy involves removing that portion of the brain responsible for igniting the seizures. A new and less invasive alternative to the full-on surgical approach involves using a laser to burn the offending brain tissue rather than removing it.
And one of the really exciting advances in the past couple of years has been laser ablation. And so unlike a removal where you go in and shell out or literally suck out the tissue, here we burn the tissue, and we do it in a much less invasive way. Because one of the really neat engineering advances is people have been able to image temperature using MRI scans. So that means I can tell if I'm heating a piece of the brain just from an MRI scanner. The ability to heat the brain has been around for a very long time, but it had to be done blindly. So you would place a probe, have no direct confirmation of where the probe was in the brain, and then deliver heat with, again, no direct confirmation of how much heat you delivered. Now I can put in through a hole about the size of a pencil tip a laser probe that's compatible with being in the MRI scanner, so it's completely safe to then take the patient with the probe in place into the MRI scanner. I can see exactly with the MRI scanner where the probe is, and then I can see exactly how much heat I'm giving. So now the device can measure exactly how much injury I'm creating. And so I can tailor the damage exactly to the seizure focus and leave the rest of the brain healthy and intact.
This laser ablation method of treating epilepsy is fairly new, but the results, according to Dr. Ogeman, are promising.
It's only been around for about 3 or 4 years, and we started doing it in Seattle over 2 years ago. We've done over 30 patients with it. It's been very successful and seems to be almost as successful as open surgery for treating seizures, but with a much more agreeable side effect profile, much better side effect profile. So we are not seeing the same degree of short-term memory problems. Patients don't have to be in the hospital nearly as long for people with who may be a little bit older or have some mild medical problems. It seems to be a much safer approach than doing the open operation.
Another new technology that's being used at UW Medicine for certain patients that aren't candidates for surgery is called NeuroPace. Basically, it involves implanting the neurological equivalent of a heart pacemaker.
So what the NeuroPace does is offers an alternative where instead of removing a piece of the brain, you place an electrode in that area, and then when it detects a seizure, it will give a small shock and try to abort that. It doesn't get rid of seizures, but it can reduce them significantly in many of the people who have it. So we're beginning that, and that's a procedure that, again, just became available in the past several months.
You're at a party over the holidays, and while in the kitchen talking to the host of the party, you suddenly notice some unusual behavior. You tell your favorite joke, and the host only gives you a half smile. Half of his mouth is drooping. He then waves goodbye to a guest, but his arm drifts downward. You jest that his punch must have been spiked, and he responds with slurred speech that's difficult to understand. And that's when you realize your friend is not drunk, he's having a stroke.
Stroke, in general, is defined as an abnormal
function of the brain, usually a permanent injury caused by an abnormality of the blood vessels supplying the brain.
David Tirschwell is a professor of neurology and co-director of the Comprehensive UW Medicine Stroke Center at Harborview Medical Center. The term comprehensive being an official designation that indicates Harborview is capable of treating the most complicated stroke cases. More on that designation later.
The vast majority of strokes are caused by a blockage of a blood vessel, and then the brain starves and some of it dies, and that permanent injury due to the blockage is the stroke. There's another variety where the blood vessels burst and there's hemorrhaging either into the brain itself or around the base of the brain, and that's a smaller subset of strokes, but still a very important part.
Stroke is quite common, especially as our population ages. It's presently the fourth leading cause of death. Kira Becker, also a professor of neurology, is the other co-director of the UW Medicine Stroke Center at Harborview.
First and foremost, high blood pressure is the main risk factor for stroke. And it's been said that about half of all strokes are attributed to hypertension that's been poorly treated.
Three ways to avoid a first stroke. So healthy living, which includes no smoking, a healthy diet, and plenty of exercise. Number two is visit your doctor regularly so that you're checking to see if you have high blood pressure, checking to see if you have diabetes, checking to see if you have high cholesterol. And then the third thing, of course, is to treat those things.
There are two levels of designation when it comes to a stroke center. There are primary stroke centers, and then there are comprehensive stroke centers. Harborview Medical Center is a comprehensive stroke center.
The comprehensive designation implies that we have the infrastructure, resources, personnel to really deal with any stroke issue.
There is one intervention for stroke that is clearly proven to improve outcome, and that's intravenous tPA. So it's a medicine that dissolves blood clots just given by vein. And the data is very clear that the sooner you get that medication, the better you do. And the metrics that have been set forth for that are that the door to needle time should be less than 60 minutes. Once someone reaches the hospital, everything should be in motion so that the ER evaluation, the CT scan, the lab tests that need to be done, and the pharmacy's ability to mix the drug should all happen so that it doesn't take any more than 60 minutes, ideally faster than that, to get the drug into them.
So the need for patients to more promptly recognize that they're having a stroke, and then the need to rapidly get them to a hospital that knows what to do with them, has been part of what's driven this whole increasing level of organization and certification for stroke centers around the country. And of course, EMS systems, emergency medical systems, and 911 call systems have been increasingly involved in helping to identify these patients, get to them quickly, and then move them quickly to an appropriate destination.
But since response time is so critical, for hospitals in outlying areas, the treatment the patient receives before they can even be transferred to Harborview makes a huge difference. And for those scenarios, the UW Medicine Stroke Center offers telestroke consultations.
It essentially allows a small hospital without a lot of neurological or stroke expertise to immediately get in contact with, for example, us here at Harborview to discuss patients, their care. We can remotely look at images that are taken at small hospitals and help make initial treatment decisions for those patients at the small places, including the possibility of using intravenous tPA. There's a treatment model called the drip and ship model, where patient comes into a small outlying hospital. They have a telestroke agreement with a more comprehensive center. They do their quick evaluation, get on the horn with the comprehensive stroke center, discuss the patient. They look like they meet all the criteria and they're a good candidate. We go ahead and advise giving it at the remote and small hospital. That treatment gets started there. Then the patient gets packaged up. And because the tPA has to drip in over an hour, it's dripping in essentially while they're being transported to the larger, more comprehensive stroke center, where additional diagnostic or testing or interventions can be entertained depending on that particular patient's circumstances.
The level of expertise here and the depth of that expertise is really striking. Like I mentioned, we have 7 board-certified stroke neurologists. In fact, I think it's 8 now. And I just don't think that any other hospital in the region has that number. And people who are really kind of involved in stroke research at its, you know, kind of roots, not just running the trials, but actually creating the trials and doing the science, and not just the clinical science, but the basic science. And so it all happens here.
So what does all this mean for you? Well, as neurosurgeon Jeff Ogeman pointed out earlier in the program, there is so much about how the brain operates that we still don't know. For instance.
So you can have people who have very large lesions, either from surgery or stroke or other things, and you really can't tell. They can't tell that anything's wrong. And you have other people with relatively small injuries, and they may have very difficult problems with their memory. Even what we call memory, we don't really understand.
But what we do understand about the human brain is rapidly expanding. A lot of the advances have come from technology, like more detailed imaging of the brain that allows for better diagnoses and less invasive, more accurately targeted treatments. But there's also the progress that comes from experience. Treating 700 to 800 of the most complicated stroke cases every year gives you tremendous insight into what works best. And whether we're talking Alzheimer's, epilepsy, or stroke, realizing that there's more than just neurology in play when it comes to these diseases. Once again, Dr. Grabowski from the Memory and Brain Wellness Center at UW-Medicine.
One of the things that we are proud of about our clinic is we really have a multidisciplinary team. So when you come to see us, we are neurologists, psychiatrists, geriatricians, neuropsychologists. We have a great care management follow-up team consisting in a nurse practitioner and a social worker. So whatever the aspect of the problem is, we have someone on the team who's an expert in that area.
I want to thank Drs. Thomas Grabowski, Jeff Ogeman, Kira Becker, and David Tershwell for joining us on today's show. To find out more about the neurology services offered at UW-Medicine, including the Memory and Brain Wellness Center, Epilepsy Treatment and Research, and the Comprehensive Stroke Center at Harborview, visit our website, uwmedicine.org/pulse. And please subscribe to this podcast on iTunes to get every episode as soon as they are released. UW Medicine Pulse is produced by Tina Knoll, associate producer Aaron Gervais, written by Patrick McGlone. I'm Marty Reamer. Thanks for listening.